This is Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. It's our prayer here at Mission to Israel that our time together will inspire you, give you insight into current events, and reveal your place in God's plan. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scottsbluff, Nebraska 69363. Or contact us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
Isaiah chapter 33, verse 22. I hope you're not getting tired of it. Yahweh is our judge. Yahweh is our lawgiver. Yahweh is our king, and he will save us. I hope you're not getting tired of it, and I hope instead it's becoming a part of your life, that it's having an impact and effect upon you, that you're seeing, Father, you're seeing what that really, what that, all that is really meant there in that passage as Isaiah was inspired to write it, to see it and understand it, that it would become a part of your very being, that you would seek indeed in every aspect of your life that Yahweh would be your king, judge, and lawgiver, and Savior, of course, in Yeshua the Christ. You know, anyone at all familiar with the Bible knows that idolatry is a transgression of the second commandment. And I didn't check it out, but I'm very confident. I think it's safe to say that idolatry is addressed and condemned in the Bible more than any other sin or any other commandment transgression or violation. You know, you really go back, and I hadn't thought about it before, but you go back and you really look at the Old Testament and idolatry, 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 second commandment violation is dealt with time and time and time again. And I can't see, if I'm wrong and somebody knows that it's otherwise, I'm sure I'll certainly entertain the thought and correct it in another message. But I really believe that probably idolatry is that one sin that is dealt with and condemned more than any other. And probably the reason being is that it and first commandment transgression is at the core of almost, if not, every other sin. Because when we sin, what are we doing? We're replacing, we're removing Christ as Lord and King in our lives with either ourselves or with something else that causes us to sin and commit a violation of any of the other Ten Commandments. And so I think that that's the reason probably why idolatry is dealt with probably more than any other sin. But when it comes to idolatry, especially as we look at it from an old covenant dispensation perspective, most people, when we look at it from that perspective, most people are baffled at how the Israelites of old could have been so stupid as to believe that what they themselves cut down, cut up, carved, and fashioned with their own hands could have been a God worthy of their adoration, their devotion, and their obedience. How in the world? I mean, here they carve it, they cut it down, or they take the ore and put it in a bowl and heat it up till it's a liquid, and then they take it and cool it down, and they form it with their own hands. And whether it was made of wood or silver, gold or bronze or whatever else it was, they set it up and before them, and all of a sudden they're bowing down to this thing that they created with their own hands. How in the world could they have been so stupid? And while we look back at them bewildered at their folly and thereby detaching ourselves therefrom, why, we would never do such a stupid thing. Many times we are blinded thereby to the very same sin in our own lives. No, we don't literally carve a wooden idol out of out of a tree or fashion one out of silver and gold. But I assure you that idolatry is nonetheless well and alive today. We don't do those things. There may be some cultures that still do them, but we don't do those. Israel doesn't do those things anymore. But it is still well and alive today, possibly even more so now than in the days of Israel of old. Listen to me, man's basic immorality hasn't changed any more than Yahweh's basic morality has changed. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever, and guess who else is as well? Israel. Because their basic immorality hasn't changed a bit. Modern man has simply refined the practice, or you might say they sophisticated the sin. That's all. They've just changed it, they sophisticated it. We wouldn't do what they did. But we do what they do, in essence, when it comes to idolatry, because anything that man fashions with his own hands or with his heart that places before Yahweh is idolatry. In other words, and now listen to me. In other words, idolatry is anything man-made that interferes with or prevents us from seeking first Yahweh, His kingdom, and His righteousness. Anything that would prevent or would interfere with our doing so. Including, and perhaps especially, at least at this time in history, the Constitution of the United States of America. Was it something that was fashioned by the hearts, fashioned by the hearts of men and then thereby with their hands? At least for some people. At least for some people, and they can't see the idolatry they commit any more than the Israelites of old could. For example, I recently had a fellow email me all upset that I would dare challenge the sacred documents of our founding fathers, the sacred documents of our founding fathers. So upset that he nearly equated me with the Antichrist and with the mark of the beast. In fact, he talked about the number 666 and that I had had it. I was manifesting it because of what I was doing. Well, and I don't have his initial email any longer, but I kept how I responded to him and then his response to my response. I responded to him in the following fashion. Dear so-and-so, I have honored your request to remove your name from our email address book. In parting, I would ask you to consider two thoughts. First, you have made some serious accusations against me. If what you have accused me of is untrue, then you are a false accuser. I forgive you, but if you know the word of God, like your email would suggest you should, you know that false accusation is a very serious matter with Yahweh, and therefore, if you cannot prove your accusations, you might want to yet take up the matter with him. Secondly, in Proverbs 18:13, we're told that, quote, he that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame unto him. In other words, those who would do so are a fool. Perhaps you should have requested the free CDs or tapes and heard me out before jumping to such quick conclusions. Blessings, Ted R. Weiland. He responded back in the following fashion, all in caps, so you know where this is going. We shall all stand one day before the eternal commander-in-chief. He will then judge all who deliberately made the secular disconnect from his work in forming this nation, his divine institution, the United States of America. The naked justification for assisting in the removal of, quote, one nation under God, his Ten Commandments, and of course this series is all about his Ten Commandments particularly, etc., will then be called to account. All Christians who died defending this client nation, I'm not sure what he means by client nation. If somebody knows what his intention there is, you can tell me afterwards. But he says, all Christians who died defending this client nation of God will witness these proceedings, offer excuses then, don't waste them on me now. End of that quote. But the reason I wanted to share that with you, I wanted you to note how, in particular, how this idolater, because that's what he's proven himself to be, claimed that the United States of America was a divine institution. And I know you've heard that before. That's not all that common for constitutionalists and patriots alike to say, that or the Constitution itself, that they're divine institutions. But where, I would ask you, did he get the authority to make such a claim? That the United States of America is a divine institution. The Bible certainly doesn't make such a claim. So where did he get the authority to make? I wonder if it's not a little bit of me, the people, you know, in the singular rather than the plural. On the other hand, his and other rabid constitutionalists' devotion to the United States of America, the Constitution, and other so-called founding documents remind me of the Ephesians' irrational devotion to Diana. Turn with me to Acts chapter 19. Let's read about Diana, because not everyone will be familiar with it. Acts chapter 19, beginning with verse 21. And there we find this account, and it says, "And these things were after these things were ended, Paul purposed in the Spirit, when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, to go to Jerusalem, saying, 'After I have been there, I must also see Rome.' So he went into Macedonia, so he sent into Macedonia two of them that ministered unto him, Timotheus and Erastus. But he himself stayed in Asia for a season, and the same time there arose no small stir about the way." Of course, speaking of Christianity. Verse 24, "For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen, whom he called together with the workmen of like occupation, and said, 'Sirs, we know that by this craft we have our wealth. Moreover, we see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but also throughout all Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands.'" And I would add to that, that therefore no valid, there are no valid constitutions that are formed with the minds of man's or fashioned with the hands of men. Adding to what he said, continuing though, verse 27 and 28, "So that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that temple of the great goddess Diana," or maybe we can insert "this great nation of the Constitution of the United States, founded upon the United States Constitution, should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. And when they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, 'Great is Diana of Ephesus. Great is Great is Diana.'" In fact, they went on for 2 hours with that mantra. "Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Great, divine is the United States of America. Maybe they don't say so much divine, but how many times are we told it's become a mantra as well? "Great is the United States of America. Great is the United States of America. Great is the United States of America." And nobody examines America, the United States of America, in comparison to even the rest of the world, let alone something that surpasses it beyond our imagination, the kingdom of Yahweh here on earth as it is in heaven, or at least as it should be here on earth as it is in heaven. "Great is the Constitution. Great is the Bill of Rights." And it goes on and on. Brethren, it's just a modern sophistication of the same old sin of idolatry. I say, great is Yahweh, and great is his kingdom, and great is his law, and that it only is divine, perfect, inspired, and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect or complete, thoroughly furnished unto every good work. Great is our God. Amen. Great is the United States of America. She may have been great. Well, do you want to know what once made her great and what will make her great again? Ask de Tocqueville. He understood. He came here, that Frenchman, that French historian. came here to find out what was it that made America great. And I've used the quote enough, I won't use it again. You know what it was that he found that made America great. Or better yet, ask Moses, what made us great? Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as Yahweh my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land whither you go to possess it. Keep, therefore, and do them. For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation, De Tocqueville, came over here because everybody else at a later time in Israel's history, back in not the early 1700s, but looking back to the early 1600s, and he did look back to the 1600s, even though he came in the 1700s, and he said, what was it that made this nation great? And came to the very same conclusion that Moses pointed out here in Deuteronomy. Surely, and they'll say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great? Who hath a God so nigh unto them, as Yahweh our God is, and in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all the law which I set before you this day? What made the United States of America great? She once was great. She's not great anymore, because she's left behind what made her great and has moved on to other things. It was and will again be the Constitution. Not the Constitution of the United States of America. That was the beginning of her downfall. But the Constitution of Yahweh, our King. Seemed too far to be. I mean, again, I can imagine people saying, man, this is too far out to think that we can actually have Yahweh as our King. Yeah, it was too far out for Israel at one time, too. And God condemned her because she looked to have other kings or other presidents, senators and congressmen, like all the other nations around her. Now, I suspect that if at another time I had asked the man who accused me of almost being the Antichrist, if he believed those words that I just shared with you from 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, I believe that he and other constitutionalists would have responded, yes, absolutely, I believe those words. But they don't. They don't. Oh, well, they might believe the first part, you know, that Yahweh's word is inspired. But they don't believe the second part, that it's sufficient in and of itself to provide us everything that we need. That it's sufficient in and of itself for us individually and or collectively, to make us into what Yahweh wants and intends us to be. They don't believe the second part. You know, there is many a professing Christian who claims he believes in sola scriptura. In fact, I suspect there's probably amongst the constitutionalists, I think probably the majority of them are Reformed Presbyterians, and they probably use that term and claim it more than anyone else. There's many a Christian man and woman who claims to believe in sola scriptura who don't. That's just a claim. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, and he will profess unto them, I never knew you. Many will claim on that day, I believed in sola scriptura, and he will declare to them, oh, no, you didn't. Oh, no, you didn't. They don't. And who therefore makes an idol of anything he would add to the word of Yahweh. The United States Constitution, as good in some respects as it is, was in fact a declaration by the men who wrote it and those today who want to return to it that Yahweh's word, his law, is insufficient. That's what it's a testimony to. The preamble, take the preamble, begins in part, we the people, dot, 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 in order to form a more perfect union, dot, 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 do ordain and establish this Constitution. Now, granted, that statement referred specifically to English rule, But don't miss, it also implies that Yahweh's kingdom and his laws are less than perfect, or they would have gone back to his constitution instead of creating their own. You know, they saw neither English rule or obviously not Yahweh's law as perfect, and so they went about to establish their own perfect rule. And they didn't get it done, as good as it is in some respects. They didn't get it done because it's not God's constitution. It's not based on totally, 100% based on his perfect laws. And like it or not, it's the same today with constitutionalists such as Chuck Baldwin. This will be You Might Be a Christian If, part 13, in response to Chuck Baldwin's You Might Be a Constitutionalist If. We left off in the previous two messages ago with, we left off with number 18. Didn't even get to one of the numbers in the last message because we were dealing with one of his later emails or at that time, for those who weren't here. So we left off a couple of messages ago with number 18. Let's pick it up with Chuck Baldwin's number 19. Quote, "You might be a constitutionalist if you believe that the federal government has no business bribing churches and faith-based organizations with federal tax dollars," end of quote. And this, of course, is in reference to some of George Bush Jr.'s legislation since taking office. Part of my email response follows, quote, "You might be a Christian if you believe that government has no business licensing churches or ministries in the first place," end of quote. No preacher needs a license to preach the gospel other than the one already provided to him in Mark 16:16. That is, if Yahweh Yahshua is truly your king. No preacher needs any other license to do what he does and to preach what he preaches other than the commission, the license, if you will, given to him by Yahshua in Mark 16:16, that's where he said, and he said unto them, "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel." Once you've gotten permission from the government to do so, or once you have petitioned them for a license to do so, doesn't say that. "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, and he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that disbelieveth shall be condemned." And yet, most American preachers not only pay homage, to today's non-Christian government by declaring that Christians are obligated to obey all government authority, no matter how wicked they are, but they have also been licensed by the government to preach a tax-exempt gospel. And they do so via their annual Mecca to the Eternal Revenue Service to petition, something you do to a god, to petition the government for a renewal of their churches, their church or ministry's 501c3 tax-exempt status. Now, do they know that's what they, I mean, do they realize what they're doing? I don't think probably the majority do, but it doesn't change the fact that that's what they've done. You know, being oblivious to the law is no excuse. You know, that we know, that's not how they put it. What, how do they put it? Not oblivious, but ignorance of the law is no excuse. That came right out of the Bible. I forget exactly where, but came right out of the law of Yahweh. That's where we gleaned that from. So it matters not with God's law. Just because you're oblivious to what you've done doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to be held guilty for what you've done. They should know what they're doing. The remainder of my email response, quote, "Furthermore, you might be a Christian if you believe that churches have no business entering into a symbiotic relationship with government via the 501c3 tax-exempt status provided by the government." In the June-July 1988 edition of the Upright Ostrich, odd name, I know, but think about it. It's a good title, the Upright Ostrich. He doesn't have his head buried in the sand. Art Fisher elaborated on the very, very serious nature of the sin that we're talking about. Quote, "A church that voluntarily," listen carefully, "a church that voluntarily initiates an application to the state for a corporate status and a tax exempt or tax and tax exemption, which would be the 501c3 status, has petitioned the state to dictate its right to exist and prosper. And you think, oh, come on, that's just stretching it. Is it? Listen to this. Thus, the church consents to a change of its status from a lawful assembly. Now, you're going to notice the difference again. He understands, obviously, the same thing, the difference between lawful and legal. He says, thus, the church consents to a change of its status from a lawful assembly of private citizens, lawful comes from God, to that of a legal gathering of public subjects. Churches, a congregation of believers, do not have rights granted by the Constitution. He also understands the difference there. They have inalienable rights granted by God. Incorporated churches and artificial persons do not have inalienable rights. They only have such rights, privileges, and immunities as granted to entities created by the state. End of quote. And I thought we were going to get into a quote here of the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll get into a little bit later. We're going to come back to more of his quote here a little bit later here. Very, very important words. I hope you're not lost by them. Bishop Leonard H. Bullock, I think is probably how you pronounce it, of the North Carolina Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Churches in America, provided an inside witness to the fact of what he just talked about. That is that incorporated churches, which are 99.9% of the churches today, that incorporated churches, listen to me, are agents of the state rather than ambassadors of Christ. Here's what he said. I have a copy of this letter. It was written to a personal friend of me. He was going to the Lutheran church about being married, performing the marriage rather, and without a state license, and this was part of what the pastor, what Pastor Bullock responded. Quote, very short, he said, the church, speaking of incorporated 501c3 churches, the church, when it comes to marriage, which was the issue at hand, the church, when it comes to marriage, is an agent of the state. End of quote. In other words, the weddings they perform are not on behalf of Yahweh, but on behalf of the state. That's why the state provides a state marriage license to the presiding pastor to present to the state-sanctioned marriage. Something completely unheard of, not all that long ago, in the United States of America. And if I remember, I didn't have time to look it up, but I think it was in the 1960s. Was it 1960s? Maybe it was back further than that. But certainly in the 20th century, totally unheard of before the 20th century, and I think in the 1960s when the first state license was ever issued. Things have changed, people. Been very subtle. Now to where most parents would get totally upset if their children would seek to be married without the state's permission. An institution created by God, not the state. But now the state has weaved their way into the church and into all these functions. And by the way, Bullock was not limiting the state's involvement in incorporated churches to simply marriage. Incorporated churches are agents of the state in all matters that the state as its creator dictates. They are an agent of the state. You know, in early America, as I know you've all heard before, in early America, the early American rallying cry of the 16th century American patriots was no, listen, think about it. It's what I'm talking about. No king but King Jesus. Now, I of course would say Yahweh or Yeshua, but nonetheless, they're talking about the same. No king but King Jesus. That was the early rallying. That was back in the 1600s, the early rallying cry of American patriots. And yet, think about it, what did the framers, as they're called today, what did the framers turn around and do once the Revolutionary War had been won? They simply provided for another type of king, one called president. And I assure you, the King George of in their day didn't hold a candle to the king, I mean President George, of our day when it comes to despotism and corruption. Didn't hold a candle to him. Back to the early American rallying cry, no king but King Jesus. One of the primary causes of those who rallied around that cry was, now think about this, especially in contrast to where we find ourselves today, was their rebellion against unjust and excessive taxation. By the way, nothing compared to the unjust and excessive taxation we've got today. Not even an inch of what we've got today. But in contrast, today's churches and ministries solicit the government. Their rallying cry, no king but King Jesus, was against unjust and excessive taxation. Flip the coin over today. And in contrast, today's churches and ministries solicit the government for their tax-exempt status. And therefore, they must make sure that they submit to all mandates, commandments, statutes, and judgments of their Creator that He has instituted, that their King has instituted, in order not to incur the wrath of this God. What a turnaround. No king but Yahshua to now, no king but Caesar. The very same thing that put Christ on the cross. And, well, Pilate, you going to crucify your king? We don't have any king but Caesar. Don't think that the churches today wouldn't do the same thing. They're doing the same thing. They're crucifying all over again. Case in point, in election years, James Dobson, the founder of Focus on the Family, a very good man in many regards, very good man, and in many ways doing more than a whole lot of others. But case in point, come election years, he often reminds his readers that as a 501c3 entity, he is not permitted to do certain things made illegal by his creator and handler. Now, he doesn't say it that way, at least the last part. But what else? How else can you interpret it? Let me share it with you. Personal letter to subscribers, October 1992, page 2. Quote, you may be thinking, but who are the good guys who have stood up for the family in Washington, and who are the legislators who have opposed and undermined it? And you'd think he'd say, well, it's so-and-so is on the good side and so is on the bad side. No, he says, I am not permitted by the tax code to answer that question as a representative of Focus on the Family. End of quote. That should shock us to our boots, people. Now, that's probably an aberration. You probably read something into that that he didn't really mean. Personal letters to subscribers, November 1992, very next month, page 6. Quote, there are lobbying limits imposed on Focus on the Family by the IRS. Focus on the Family as a tax-exempt organization will never go too far in that direction, that is, the endorsement or opposition of political candidates, because it must remain true to the original character of the ministry. End of quote. And I'm not trying to condemn James Dobson. I appreciate and love the man for that which he does that is good, but that was wrong. And in fact, it was actually ungodly. The original character of the ministry is equivalent to saying the mandates of its creator. God is not the head of Focus on the Family. The United States government is. That's who created. When James Dobson and anyone else involved therein went down and petitioned the government for a 501c3 tax-exempt status, for that part of his ministry. Now, he's maybe starting to figure some things out, because in recent years he's formed some other side organizations that he has not gone tax exempt for, so that he can speak out. But what about this one? And what does it say to the people? And the mandates, it's the original character of the ministry is equivalent to saying the mandates of its creator, and therefore, it's God and King. Contrast those admissions by by Dr. Dobson, with the admonitions of King Solomon and the prophet Ezekiel and the apostle Paul, where in Proverbs 24:24-25, Solomon wrote, "He that saith unto the wicked, thou art righteous, him shall the people curse, and the nation shall abhor him." Now, Dobson doesn't do that. He doesn't say to the wicked, "Thou art righteous." But it goes on, and it says, "But to them that rebuke him shall be delight, and good blessings shall come upon them." Well, you say he rebukes them. Not by name. Not by name. Ezekiel 33:1-6. "Again, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, when I bring a sword upon the land..." I'm leaving some of this passage out so we don't have to read the whole thing. But he says, "When I bring the sword upon the land, if the watchmen see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, his blood will I require at the watchman's hand." They're coming, they're coming, they're coming. But I'm not permitted to tell you who they are. But they're coming, they're coming, they're coming. You think that's going to stand with God? I don't think so. In Ephesians 5:11, Paul wrote, "And do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness." And he indeed fulfills that much, I'm sure of. But it goes on and it says, "But instead, expose them." And you cannot expose them unless you name them. Just like Paul and Peter and John did oftentimes, Demetrius the silversmith and others, that they literally named to warn the people. Not just they're coming, but I can't tell you who. Yahweh commands his servants to expose evil and those who participate therein, whereas today's government God commands his servants, specifically Christian pastors and ministry leaders, to keep their mouths shut about such things. And so many do, and many more will, anytime the government threatens to take away their tax-exempt status. But I assure you that Yahweh is not going to tolerate. He will not tolerate such double-mindedness. Take Amos chapter 5, 25-27, for example. He says, "You offered unto me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness, O house of Israel." And you'd think that was a lead-in to praise, right? That he was going to laud and praise them. Not so. "You have offered unto me sacrifices and offerings in the wilderness for 40 years, O house of Israel, but you have borne the tabernacle of your Moloch, and Chion, your images, the star of your God, which you made for yourselves." You can substitute any God today. We don't have the same ones today, but substitute any God, any idol we've created today, and it still works. "Therefore will I cause you to go into captivity, saith Yahweh, whose name is the God of hosts." You want to know why we're in captivity today? And most people haven't even figured that out. Do you want to know why we're in captivity today? Because we're sacrificing to him. We're making offerings to him. While we carry along our other idols along the way, like the Constitution of the United States of America, which denies him as our king, judge, and lawgiver. Christians may worship. They may sacrifice at their churches. Many do. They sacrifice by going there, by being there. They sacrifice with their prayers and their praise and all that they do there. But listen to me, obedience is the true measure for determining which of the two gods a person truly serves and whom is his king, judge, and lawgiver. Churches and ministries that have formed this unholy, symbiotic, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, relationship with today's man-made government cannot expose government sinners. Deal with those in your congregation or those in your neighborhood. Just don't deal with us. Because if they do, they will incur the wrath of this God and possibly lose his blessings. You see, all gods have blessings. That is, their tax-exempt status and accompanying benefits. Churches and ministries would also lose support from followers who worship the same God at the church, the 501c3 incorporated churches do, and who want their own tax benefits provided by their God. Art Fisher expanded on his previous thoughts regarding U.S. corporations, including 501c3 churches and ministries. He said this, now listen carefully, the U.S. Supreme Court understands corporations are creatures of the state, creations of the state. As the court has stated, quote, listen carefully to this, a corporation, that's what the churches have come, they've petitioned the government to become corporations. A corp, quote, a corporation is a creature of the state. It is presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. It receives certain special privileges and franchises. Its powers are limited by law, or by what should have been said, legislation. Its rights to act as a corporation are preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws or the legislation of its creator. End of quote. Wilson versus U.S. 221, U.S. 382. Supreme Court. I mean, the churches may not know what they've done, but the Supreme Court does. And as it would have it to be, you think our government doesn't want the churches to be creations of the state rather than creations of God, that they wouldn't be looking? You think they don't want them looking to the government as their God, King, Judge, and Lawgiver rather than Yahweh? Tell you what, if our people can ever get this figured out, Christianity, Christendom, you know, the day it figures it out, I'm going to quit calling it Christendom. I'm going to call it Christenbright. Or Christensmart. Well, time they figure this out. And they don't want them to figure it out, because the time we figure it out, the time that Christendom becomes Christensmart, we're going to turn this nation around and we're going to take it back for our God, King, Judge, and Lawgiver. But you can almost hear them, can't you? You know, you can almost hear some of the preachers thinking to themselves, why, if we weren't a 501c3 church and corporation, our supporters would send their donations where they were tax exempt, and I'd soon be out of a job. In other words, their parishioners' love of money, exhibited by the demands that their offerings and tithes be tax exempt, dictate that these same ministers be idolaters as well. Like the people, like priests. And one of the prophets put it that way, like the people, like priests. Such preachers fulfill perfectly, like I have at least never seen it before, such preachers fulfill perfectly the description provided by the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 56, 10 and 11, where he said this, he said, his watchmen are blind. They don't even know that they don't even know what a 501c3 thing is for the most part. Talk about blind. His watchmen are blind. All of them know nothing. All of them are dumb dogs unable to bark. Or in our case, not just unable. Some are unable, but worse yet, most of them are unwilling. Could bark, but unwilling to bark. Verse 11, and the dogs are greedy. Greedy. And that's why they're unwilling to bark. Greedy, my, if I taught this to the people and we weren't 501c3, they'd go send their money somewhere else instead of here. And the dogs are greedy, they are not satisfied, and they are shepherds who have no understanding. They have all turned their own way, each one to his unjust gain, to the last one. End of quote. Nothing's new under the sun. What they had then, we've only sophisticated today. It's still happening today. Chuck Baldwin's number 20. He says, quote, you might be a constitutionalist if you believe that federal agents who murder American citizens should be held to the same laws and punishments that any other citizen should be held to. My email response, you might be a Christian if you believe that there should be no federal agents in America and that all people should be judged equally under the laws of Yahweh. End of quote. Think about it. If every able-bodied man, 20 years and older, were armed in protection of himself, his family, his community, and his nation, and if the judgments of Yahweh were brought into play immediately following a speedy trial, Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and verse 11, and if immigration was limited to Israelites only, America would be the absolute safest place on the face of this earth. And we wouldn't therefore need any of the federal alphabet gang as we've got them today. Chuck Baldwin's number 21, quote, "You might be a constitutionalist if you understand that NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, and FTAA are disastrous compromises of America's national sovereignty and independence," end of quote. My email response on this one is the same as given to a couple previous points. Therefore, I won't elaborate upon it any more than I did previously. You can always go back and find that elaboration. But my email response is again, quote, "You might be a Christian if you understand that the United States has no business making treaties with any non-Christian or non-Israelite nation," end of quote. Chuck Baldwin's number 22, "You might be a constitutionalist if you would like to see congressmen and senators be required to actually read a bill before passing it into law," end of quote. Now, granted, that sure sounds like a rational, common sense, good idea. A good answer to a good question. I said it sounds like it. But in this instance, I'm not so sure that it's even a good answer to a good question. Because so what if they read it, if they're going to pass it anyway? You know, the result's the same whether they read it or not. I'll not ever forget the time back, and I believe it was in 1989, when a bunch of men, Christian men, went down to Washington, D.C. We walked the halls of, I can't remember if it was the House or the Senate. I think the Senate was out at that time, so it was just the House, or vice versa, it doesn't matter. But we, as two of us, were at a particular, I believe it was a representative's office. Very cordial to us, very kind, glad that we came in. But his time was short because he said, "Well, I'm going to have to leave here anytime they're going to call me for a vote down at the House." And time came, and he even invited us to walk down to the House with him to go make this vote. And as he left, he looked at two aides that came out of the thing, and he says, "Now, this is an upvote on this one, isn't it?" And they said, no, it's down. Let me tell you, he obviously hadn't read it or paid any attention to it. But had he, he'd have still gone and voted just like his aides told us. By the way, it's not the representatives and the senators that run Washington, D.C. It's their aides. That was good proof of it. But it wouldn't make any difference whether he had read it or not. So what's the right answer to the right question? Did you give me a time thing there? Okay. What's the right answer to the right question then? My email response, quote, "You might be a Christian if you would like to see all politicians replaced with biblically appointed leaders who must write out their own copy of Yahweh's laws, read them daily, abide by them, and see that they are enforced." End of quote, from Deuteronomy 17, 18 through 20. That's the right answer to the right question. Honestly, which of the two is going to provide the results that both we and the constitutionalists want to see? If the constitutionalists are honest, that's the answer. Not have them read the bills they're going to pass anyway. Chuck Baldwin's number 23, "You might be a constitutionalist if you understand that it is the job of government to protect and secure God-given rights, not use its power to take those rights away." I failed this one too. I'm not a constitutionalist. Now, because he didn't state them in this instance, I'm not exactly sure what God-given rights Baldwin is referring to, but I would suppose, in fact, I'm pretty confident that among others, that he's referring to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That, if you'll remember, I dealt with in the last message, and you can go hear how I responded to those in the last message. Perhaps, in fact, most likely, I suspect he's also referring to the right to worship as we see fit, which is, or at least can be, and often is, more often than not, a violation of the first and second of the Ten Commandments. And therefore, a government that protects that right, as the constitutionalists would have it, is no better than the person who chooses to worship other gods than Yahweh. They're just protecting their right to be obedient to the first and second commandments, as it's used today. And by the way, when did it become the job of the government, and who gave it the power to protect people's rights? Nobody's asking the questions that need to be asked here. Well, the answer to the latter question is, of course, we the people. who never had the right to give the government that power in the first place. Now, follow with me, because while we the people did not have the right or the authorization to give that power of protection to the government, follow with me, we the people in this instance, specifically every able-bodied man 20 years and older, had the power, the authority, the commission to protect themselves, families, communities, and nation. And if men had not shirked that responsibility, their God-given, not right, their God-given responsibility, as they are so prone to do, always looking for someone else to do it for them, demonstrated in all of our insurances today, demonstrated in Social Security and all the other myriad of government handouts. But if men had not shirked their responsibility in that regard, we wouldn't have to worry about whether the government is taking away or protecting our rights. Wouldn't have to worry about it. And of course, I'm speaking now of genuine God-given rights, or really responsibilities, because God doesn't deal so much with rights. He deals in responsibilities. The right, the responsibility to worship Yahweh. By the way, note the importance of naming him by identifying him by name. Otherwise, it's left to the reader's discretion and therefore his choice whom he serves. It's important to name him. Some would have you, oh, it's not important, it's not important. Well, it was important enough for God to put his name nearly 7,000 times in the Old Testament. That man decided by his own volition to change and replace with something else. But the right, talking about the real rights or the real responsibilities, the responsibility to worship Yahweh, another God-given right or responsibility, the responsibility to pursue and further his kingdom in exclusion to all others, the responsibility to teach and implement and enforce his laws, the responsibilities of the stewardship of his land allotments without the fear of confiscation.